what's going to happen in this next 40 minutes or so is I'm going to answer some questions that you didn't ask, okay, but you should have, all right? And then we'll start with that. Then I'll meddle just a little bit, and then I'll open up for questions and answers, and I'll try not to say anything too insulting or controversial during this hour. We'll save that for later. We'll save that for later on. Okay, yes, as Pastor Chuck said, we've known each other for quite, not too many years, what, 2-3 years? Well, that, you know, when you were young? Okay. All righty. This is the right place, New Life Community Church, okay, and that's today's date, so we're here doing the right thing. All right. Question comes up. You guys are Baptists. Talking with Muslims, oftentimes, the question is that group any good? You know, is this Baptist church good? Or are the Moravians good? Or how about the Presbyterians? And when I was first asked questions like that, you know, man, we'd have to do some horrible dancing, you know, because I'd say, well, if we're talking about Presbyterians, OPC are okay, but they're kind of stodgy. PCUSA, watch out for them. But PCA, that's okay. And I'm going through all these initials and confusing my Muslim friend who's asking the question. And I'm also saying, whoa, we're drawing big lines of division, you know, throughout the church. They're looking and saying, oh, we're Muslims, you know, one great big happy ummah, one happy family. We're all united, believe the same thing, Quran's all the same, and everything like that. So what happens is I'm there trying to explain and draw divisions and be careful, but at the same time I'm saying, division, division, division. So we had to come up with a better answer on that. And so what we did, we started thinking about the issue of sacred writings. Okay, and this is probably, I think this is one of the best things that I've come out with in 40-some years. Okay, that's why I'm starting with it, which means, yes, everything else is downhill after this. Okay, but there's two ways of thinking about sacred writings. The first way is that it's revelational. The second way, the other way, is it's evolutionary. Revelational or evolutionary? All right, now thank you. So let's unpack that a little bit. They used to make fun, Chuck and the Davies and us used to go to Trinity Baptist Church, and they used to make fun of the way I drank water. And I still drink it the same way. two ways, revelational or evolutionary. Let's unpack those terms just a little bit, and you can see how it's kind of might be kind of useful. So evolutionary. Yes, that's on purpose, because it's... If you look at sacred writing, it's kind of evolutionary. Yeah, it is bouncy. It's fluid. It goes all over the place. So what is it? They see, yeah, it's a collection of human writings. It's just recording beliefs that are current at that point in time when whoever wrote, whatever they wrote, what they think about God and how they're interpreting God, how they are interpreting God according to cultural, social, political, and historical context. Evolutionary approach looks and says, let's use so-called scholarly attempts at understanding and dating and seeing who really wrote and what they really meant in this so-called sacred writing. The bottom line is that in it, God is a reflection of what man thinks he is. They view basically the sacred writing as, they've made God in their own image. That's how it is, okay? And you can identify probably groups like that. Now, the opposite, press the right button here. There we are, revelational. God reveals himself and eternal truths about himself and creation through human instruments. All right, real simple. It's truth, and that's here we get into key. It is truth, not a truth. It's the truth. Okay, it's real apart from the experience. Doesn't matter if man understands it. Doesn't matter if man thinks their experience links up to it in any way. It's real. God is declaring the truth. So now my Muslim friend says, well, what about such and such a group? I don't have to go and dance and throw out all kinds of alphabets. What I say is it all depends on how they view sacred writing. If it's evolutionary, that it's open to change, open to human interpretation, and it really just reflects what man thinks about God, then no, That's not a good group, and we wouldn't call them Christian, even though they might have Christian in their name, because they're denying the very thing, Christ, the reality of Christ, the absoluteness of Christ, that would give them the right to call themselves Christians. But if they have a revelational view of sacred writings, then they're good. And you know, that has worked. That satisfied my Muslim friends so much, and we just move right on from there. And it's a concept that they can grasp. So I throw that out as, you know, something that's really kind of, might be kind of useful. Okay. I came up with a brilliant idea one time, only it wasn't quite so brilliant, as you'll see. I thought to myself, because I often would talk to my Muslim friends about terrorists and this guy, you know, these people, ISIS and all that kind of stuff, and they say, well, they're not practicing Islam. They are not, you know, they're not living according to the tenets of Islam, and that's why they do all those horrible things. And so being a Western Christian-minded type of thinker, I said, oh, so if they're not practicing Islam, they're not Muslims. I said, well, you know, so I talked to a group of scholars one night and said, hey, okay, guys, you're always telling me these guys aren't practicing Islam. I said, but yet on the other hand, you talk about how Islam is like one of the world's largest religions. I said, but you're basically saying that, you know, all the major countries, the major, you know, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, all, none of them are practicing Islam. So really, isn't Islam a very small thing? A very, very small religion. And I thought, I've got them. But they said, oh, no, that's not right. Because, let's go through. All right, so what about terrorists? They're not practicing true Islam. Because Islam is a religion of peace, not compulsion in religion, and all of that. So those terrorists are not practicing true Islam. All right, there was my argument. They're not Muslims, because I made that equation, if they're not Muslims. All right, no, the number of Muslims is still extremely large because you can follow Islamic teaching or not, but if you're born a Muslim, you're a Muslim. Okay, so even though our Muslim friends would on one hand say, we don't embrace ISIS and all the stuff that they do because they're not practicing Islam, on the other hand, they would say, but they are Muslims because they're born Muslims. This difference is that obedient ones receives Allah's blessing, and disobedience will be chastised in the next life because there's a lot of, well, works and performance, basis to the whole thing. So they're born a Muslim, you stay a Muslim, and the only thing that stops you from being a Muslim is not your practice or lack of practice, is you remain a Muslim regardless of your behavior unless you renounce your faith. So there has to be a formal, sort of formal recognition, renouncement, and then a person no longer is. Sort of like being professing Christ and being baptized is a renouncement of your faith. No longer are you a Muslim, kind of a thing. Okay, so there was a brilliant idea, but boy, it crashed and burned. Oh, well, that's why I start with the other one, because that still is a good one. All right, and if I look at my screen, it'll tell me what's up next. All right, so we are Western. And Western people, we like to categorize things, right? You know, you go to Staples and you look at, you know, get all these kind of little drawers and slots to categorize and stuff like that, and us guys buy them and then still pile papers on top of our desk until our wife yells at us. Okay, but we're Western, we like to categorize things. So to try to understand Muslims, here we are, types of Muslims for Western thinkers. Muslims don't categorize themselves this way. According to the last thing, Muslims categorize really, are we behaving or not behaving? Are we obeying or not obeying? But this works for us. And I tested this out with some of my Muslim friends, and they said, oh, wow, we never thought of it that way. But that's really right. That's a good way of thinking about it. So the first category of Muslims we had to think about are Ramadan Muslims. And this is a title that Muslims will give to these type of guys. They're Muslims, but you wouldn't know it through most of the year by looking at how they behave, by listening to what they talk about and see and do and all of that, until Ramadan comes up, the month of Ramadan. Then all of a sudden, they will be fasting in public and feasting, in public at the end of the day, and they will keep Ramadan. Sort of like we would call them Christmas or Easter Christians, kind of, a category. There's a lot of places where it touches with behavior within so-called Christianity, too. So there are Ramadan Muslims. These are the guys. I remember walking down the street one time, seeing a couple of Muslim guys on a bench, and they're drinking beer, which really is not supposed to happen. And when I went up there and started talking to them, all of a sudden they kicked the beer cans back underneath the seat on that, because I was talking to them about faith. Now all of a sudden they had to be better Muslims, So, yeah, Ramadan Muslims. That's the first category. And there's a lot of them. Second category are the playing it safe Muslims. They want to survive. And we could break this down into two smaller categories. There's those that want to survive as a minority. In many areas of America, this is what Muslims are like. All right, they want to survive. So they try to fit in. They don't want to draw attention to themselves. They don't want to make waves. Many of them, if they have daughters, their daughters might not wear head covering or even special clothing of any sort. They'll try to dress them like Americans because they don't want to make waves. They don't want their daughters to be persecuted or picked on. The issue is they will compromise to survive. They're playing it safe. They believe, but they aren't going to let their belief get in the way too much of what they're doing. They are a minority, and they want to survive. The other category of playing it safe, pressing that button, is when they're a majority. Now, the playing it safe Muslims, they want to be comfortable as a majority. They can remember what it was like for their parents or even for themselves when they were a minority, but now they want to be comfortable. They're going to believe, but they're not going to let faith get in the way of what they believe. Okay? They'll be businessmen, and they won't be ashamed of putting Ali's grocery store on the on their banner of their store anymore, because it's okay. But they're not going to let things like maybe honesty and stuff like that get in the way of making a good living. They're going to be comfortable. They're not going to let faith get in the way. They're usually complacent unless they're challenged by a Christian. That'll be fine. You want a restaurant owner, you want to bring alcohol? Well, we won't drink it, but you can bring alcohol to your dinner with you. That's not a problem, because they're gonna make the money. They don't want to chase business away. They're compromising to be comfortable. All right, compromising is a key in both of those things for the playing it safe Muslim. That's the second category. Then the third category is it has to mean more. The Muslims who say it has to mean more. Going back up, thinking about the tie over to, or play over to Christianity, the playing it safe, oftentimes second generation Christians. Think about my family. I grew up in an unsafe family, alcoholics and smoking and cursing, and those were the good days, when at family get-togethers, really, really tough. So I come to Christ, and I am really stodgy, straight down the line, all that stuff. My kids have an experience that I never had. They're raised in a Christian family. And so they never know what it's like to have just plain out and out cursing and swearing going on at the dinner table. So their language is a little bit coarser than mine because they haven't seen how horrible it is. They're the second generation of converts, sort of are more comfortable. They're comfortable. It's really nice being a Christian. It's really nice. Kind of a thing. Then it has to mean more. Is they're the ones that are the children of the playing it safe ones. And they say, it's got to mean more than that. This religion. In Christianity, they're the ones that become missionaries or pastors or Reformed Baptists or something like that. It's got to mean more than what I saw in my parents. It's got to mean more than what I saw in my family. And so we would begin to call them radicals or extremists. This is that, where that category comes from. Faith has got to make an impact on my life. It's got to make an impact on others. It's got to make an impact on society if it's real. And so, like I said, that's the seedbed for radicals and extremists. It's the seedbed for those who are very faithful and obedient, but it's also the seedbed for where radicals and extremists come from, who get manipulated by those with political agendas and other stuff. So it has to mean more group. And then the final group is the neo-Islamic category. And this group redefines Islam to make it compatible with 21st century thinking. I was talking with one professor at a Muslim graduate school about Ramadan, the timing of fasting during Ramadan. And he was saying, wow, it's really hard right now because, you know, stop eating, no eating during sunrise hours. And sunrise is at 5 o'clock in the morning and sunset is at 10 o'clock at night. Man, this is tough. You know, we have to get up at 3 o'clock. Our wives have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to start cooking breakfast for us. And then we got to get up at 4 o'clock to eat it. And then we can't eat anything. And then, you know, to 10 o'clock at night. It's really tough. And then we were talking about other areas. And, I said, well, you know, just be glad you don't live further north, like in Sweden or Norway or something. And I said, you'd be fasting for 23 hours. And he said, well, you know, John, he says, when Islam started, they had no idea that it would ever be anything more than a tribal religion in the desert. So the sunrise, sunset worked for Ramadan. He says, but that's ridiculous to think about that, because the issue is, what does fasting mean? What are we supposed to learn about trusting God? What are we supposed to learn about giving up, you know, creature comforts and all of that? And so, no way are we going to keep fast in those hours. You know, we'll just, they make an arbitrary setting of time, maybe the time in Saudi Arabia or something like that. You see what he's doing? They're redefining to make it work. Because what rational person is going to say, yep, I'm going to fast for 23 and a half hours, and then my wife will cook me breakfast and I'll have dinner real fast. And we have to pray three times in that during the half hour too. You know, no, you know, it just doesn't work. And like he said, nobody thought Islam would ever become more than a little tribal religion in the desert. Well, that's not Islamic teaching. Well, it is if you're kind of neo. Now, you guys are pretty young. There's one or two older ones. But remember the neo-evangelical movement, which came out when I was young, where it was the idea of trying to make Christianity relevant to society. You know, that was the idea where we said, instead of having a trumpet trio on our Sunday evening service to try to draw young people, we'll play guitars in the morning and have songs that don't have 10 verses in it. You know, be trying to make Christianity relevant. That's the age of the new living Bible, you know, new translations from the King James or from the ASV to try to make it understandable. Well, that's what the neo-Islamic movement is doing, because they're looking and saying, we're now dealing with a global society. violence just doesn't cut it. You know, if we're trying to, they wouldn't use the term sell, but if we're trying to convey the message of Islam, violence just doesn't cut it within the global society that we're a part of, when we need to make it culturally relevant and meaningful. And so we have the neo-Islamic movement, and that's quite a growing thing. In fact, talking with one guy gave me a new translation of the Quran. It was actually a Quran, how do you call it? A study Quran, yeah. Yeah, not a study Bible, but a study Quran that had notes that explained a lot of the bad things in the Quran, you know, by saying, oh, well, you know, that, you know, those verses that seem like so violent, that was had a particular cultural historical setting that's not, you know, it's not a normative behavior and all of that kind of stuff. And so they will try to explain and make it more palatable. Neo. So we have those four categories: Ramadan Muslims, the playing it safe Muslims, it has to mean more Muslims, and the neo-Islamic Muslims. Now, so what? How do you know? How do you tell? Well, if you can look at them sideways and you look at their earlobe, no. There is no easy magic way like that. The best way to find out where a Muslim stands on all of that. Now this might be the second most important thing that I discovered. Okay, here it is. The best way to determine where a Muslim stands in this whole continuum is to talk to them. and a subcategory to that is then listen to how they respond. But if you have this category in the back of your head, and then you start listening to what they say, then you can begin to sort of place them and have an idea where they're coming from, and maybe a better understanding of how to talk to them, like about the gospel. Yeah, it could be useful on that. Alrighty, what's that slide up there? Oh, this was something, Bethlehem Bible College is a Bible college in, of all places, Bethlehem, but not Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where we come from, but Bethlehem, Palestine, where my grandfather came from. but I liked what it said. You want to prove that the Bible is right? We prove that the Bible is right by radical obedience to the teachings of Jesus, by proving that Jesus' teachings actually work and that they can make the world a better place. And that's sort of a segue. We're going to pick that up in the service and the sermon to come. Okay, so some of the stuff I wanted to inform you about. Just think of all the questions that you've had answered already. That was, that's pretty good. And it's only been 15 minutes. All right, that's time for another drink of water. All right, so now let's meddle a little bit. Here you are in beautiful downtown Maryland. You know, what a bucolic setting? Yeah. I don't use that word often, but this is nice. Rolling hills and everything. There should be like horse farms and stuff like that, and people with quaint little hats standing by the side giving free corn and stuff like that because the harvest was so wonderful. Where in the world would you ever run into a Muslim down here? Well, there's one place. are you familiar? That's in Parkville, but that's like 8.6 miles away from here. So that's far distance. But I bet you have some people that live down in Parkville and probably are neighbors to that. Or maybe looking at the cars out there, 8.6 miles isn't too far to drive in those nice cars. Nobody has horse and buggies, so that's okay. Let's see, what else? That's a small little place too, though. Where else would... Oh, look at that. Hey, that's closer. Where's White Marsh? Down that way, away. Oh, 7.3 miles away. Look at that. They just bought that. I think it was a used car dealer kind of a thing. And on that big one. And both of them have pretty nice websites that talk about the stuff that they do and everything like that. And they would probably be extremely happy if they ever have a festival or a community day, Saturday, type of thing, to have a group of people from a church come and visit. Although, warning you, they say it starts at 11 o'clock, don't worry about 11 o'clock, show up about 1, and and they'll just be opening up, okay? They'd probably be very happy. One mosque up by us, first Saturday of every month, they have a community dinner that is open to the community, and then whatever guests come in, they take around and show and talk and everything like that. But it's a way of beginning a relationship. Yeah, sometime later on, I'll be talking about relationships, about the best way to witness to a Muslim, or really to anybody . But it's a way to start a relationship. Oh, hey, look at this. This is off of a Muslim website. That's created to help Muslims find proper stuff around their neighborhood. So I put in the zip code of this building here, And I discovered, oh, lo and behold, I said, look at this, Safeway and ShopRite, Costco, Safeway, ShopRite, they all carry halal groceries. And I say to myself, those companies probably aren't doing that because they want their stock to go bad and they lose money. They probably do that because they have customers. Now, what kind of customers would be interested in buying halal food? All right. So one could make the assumption, you know, if all we had was Rose Bazaar and deli and the Punjab supermarket and halal meats, if that's all that was in the whole area, we'd say, okay, very limited, very limited community shopping because these two little local places are all that exist. But when I see major businesses as well as the little local places, Mount Everest Grocery mostly major businesses having halal, carry halal line, that says to me, that's because they have customers. Oh, and then over here, anybody go out for lunch for lunch on Sundays at a restaurant? Or do you ever go out to restaurants at all? Okay. Oh, look at this. All of these things here, you know, everything from the Taste of Taj and Bombay Nights to NYFC fried chicken and fish. These are all halal restaurants. Now, again, some of them, like the House of Kebab, that aims at non-Muslims, but it also aims at Iranians. That they advertise as being the place that has the largest gathering of Persian people in the Baltimore area. Go to the House of Kebab. And that's like only 9 miles from here. And it's a really good place to eat and a good buffet if you happen to be there on Friday or Saturday night. Unless you're with a bunch of people who are more interested in talking than eating, and then you end up as the last person eating and everybody else is talking and thinking about dessert. But hey, we won't get personal. But think sometime, how could I meet a Muslim? Well, one bad thing about the House of Kebab last night, we went there and our waiter was an Irish guy. And the two waitresses were American. Now the cook was Iranian, and she did come out and we talked to her a little bit. But you know, the thing is that while we were eating, at least three other Muslim families were around us. And also, last time I checked, Irish people need to know the Lord too. And American girls working as waitresses in kebab shops need to know the Lord too. So we're sitting there, and the nice thing about a Persian restaurant is you can sit there for 2 hours and nobody gets fussed. So we are right in the center of the room, six of us, right in the center of the room for 2 hours, and we're talking about life. Now, what does life involve? Well, for us, it involves grandkids, it involves job, it involves history, you know, and past, but it also involves Jesus. It involves our life in church. It involves our hopes and our aspirations and our confidence in God. And all of that, in 2 hours, that's all coming out. And we're sitting there right in the middle, and everybody in the restaurant was listening to us and got a chance to hear. And if nothing else, it showed to them, well, there is some bunch of people who take Christianity seriously. Now, just think if we were to go there like every Saturday night and talk like this, besides the fact that we would then be having problems with weight and everything. But what a ministry, what an impact it could make. Ooh, just think if different people from a church went and then could start talking to, you know, a little, because you get known. We did this with one church up in our area, up in the Allentown. We helped them start with a Turkish one, a Turkish restaurant. And they, after a while, we were on a first name basis with the son, with the waitress and the waiter who took turns. They were brother and sister. And they were the niece and nephew of the owners. and the mother cooked, and an uncle was the butcher, and one of the guys who from the church that we were helping get this thing started with, he's a really outgoing, he comes in, you know, oh, hey, Ahmed, how are you? Yeah, and he's talking to the, and then he goes over, how are you? And you know, can we pray, you know, can we pray for you for anything? Well, yeah, I'm taking my GEDs next week. You could pray for that. So, okay, all right. Then we come back the next month, say, hey, we've been praying. How did your GEDs go? You know, well, that's probably kind of unique even within Christian, with Christian, when you say, I'll pray for you. But how many people ever come back who have said, I'll pray for you about that, have come back and said, so how'd it go? I've been praying. You know, we can probably count the number of people that have done that on my hand. You know, because it doesn't often happen. But yeah, you go back and you have that continuity. And what you're showing is, like Munter said in the slide, about displaying that the Bible and Christianity is real because it makes an impact on the way that we live and the way that we deal with others. And so we say, I'm praying for you. I'm going to ask you what's happened because I expect that there'll be an answer. Because I'm not just praying to the cloud, to the sky, to a good feeling. I'm not just praying to make me feel warm and cuddly. I'm praying because God hears prayer and God intervenes and acts in the acts and involvement with humankind. Oh, wow. Hey, okay. So enough of meddling on that. Oh, I'm not getting a kickback from the House of Kebab, but you know, but I just thought that was pretty interesting. And again, here's their little thing. We can say without a doubt, House of Kebab serves to more Persian customers than any Middle Eastern eatery in the Baltimore metropolitan area. So you run into Persian Muslims who are very, very gracious people, who are very, very easy people to talk to, who are people usually very interested and open to hearing about the gospel. Hang around the House of Kebab. Okay, let's see. What's next up there? Oh, this is my last medal. Let me ask a question, though. How many people believe that prayer does really matter? Ooh, that's good. I'm setting you up. How many of you are concerned with terrorism and evil people doing so? Okay. Here is atfp.org. You say, what does that stand for? It stands for Adopt a Terrorist for Prayer. Wow. Here we are. Adopt a Terrorist for Prayer. How are we going to do anything about terrorism? Well, our government has come up with lots of ways that don't work. Really, a change of heart needs to take place. But who changes hearts? The Lord. Okay. Yeah. That's like, all right. So, we pray. You know, it's one thing to pray for the stuff that we're pretty sure is going to happen. You know, somebody's pregnant, and so we pray, Lord, give her a safe delivery. But we know in the back of our minds, hey, we're in America, we've got great health care, at least up to, you know, pretty much got a really good health care. They're healthy people, they've had a good lifestyle. That's a pretty safe prayer. Okay? Lord, keep us safe as we travel home to Bethlehem this afternoon. Well, that's a pretty safe prayer. I've got a good car, you know, and the roads are nice and everything. That's safe. How often do we pray for something that we don't see how it could work? You know, I found a guy, Muhammad here, and it took me a while, I'll confess, it took me a while to commit to praying for Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was one of the guys who... You want to hear a funny story about Muhammad? Okay. Nobody said yes, but I'm going to tell you anyway. All right. Muhammad was one of the guys in the first World Trade Center bombing, where they took the van and put it at the base and blew it up, but the World Trade Center didn't collapse. Well, he then went back to the rental agency to get his deposit back, and he was arrested. Okay. Now he is in a supermax prison in Colorado, solitary confinement, doesn't see anybody 24 hours a day, gets his meals put in. And I'm praying for Muhammad. you know, I don't have a single suggestion that I can make to God on how he can do this. People have said, well, if you're praying for Muhammad, can you send him a letter? Well, I said, yeah, but it'll get sent back to me because Muhammad can't get letters, especially from people whose name is Elias. Well, can you do this? Can you do that? Could you visit us? Nope, can't do a thing. There's no way. Can't send him a Bible. He's in solitary lockdown, like vegetative and non-cognitive vegetative state, except he's awake. There's nothing. The only way that anything can happen for Muhammad's soul is if God intervenes somehow in a way that I can't understand how it might be. Wow, what a discipline that is to pray trusting completely in God and not giving suggestions and not mapping out how to do it. Now, the neat little thing about this whole thing is Muhammad was born in Nablus, and his last name is Salama. Nablus is a little village very close to Ramallah. Ramallah is where my grandfather comes from. Ramallah, it was historically a Christian village, or meaning a non-Muslim village. Nablus was a Islamic village. But there was movement back and forth because when you needed a wife for your son, you might go to the other village and marry and get a wife because the woman is going to take the faith of her husband. So a Christian boy could take a Muslim girl for a wife because she's going to convert to Christianity, or a Muslim guy could take a Christian girl because she's going to convert to Islam. All right, so Nablus is right close. Now, his name, Muhammad Salama. If you were to be fussy, I have to write this down because it's pretty long, but if you were to be fussy, my name, and it's rather long because for 12 generations, we've been the firstborn son. Okay, the firstborn who was a son. So that's why this is the name. Here it is. Yohanan, Ibrahim, Elias, Salama, Sa'a, Awad, Hadad, Rashid, El-Hadadin, El-Ghassani. But you can call me John. Okay? But did you pick up in the middle Salama? All right, so we share the same family name ancestor on that. Muhammad and I are probably very distant cousins. Not close enough that we would, you know, do Christmas cards and stuff, but kind of good likelihood that we're distant cousins because of the proximity of our villages and the names. The other thing is, Muhammad was arrested. There was an FBI agent who had this neat idea that maybe one of the terrorists would come back to try to get their deposit back. So there was he was stationed behind the desk. And when Muhammad went in to get the money back, the FBI agent said, "Oh, glad to see you, Muhammad. By the way, I'm FBI, you're under arrest, and I'm related to John Elias." The FBI agent is my daughter's father-in-law. So we kept it a nice family event, you know, kind of a thing. But, you know, but I didn't realize all of that till after I had adopted Muhammad. At first, I just picked Muhammad because he was from Palestine. And a little bit of a family resemblance. But then the story unfolded on that. But so the point is not to say, "Oh, isn't that cute, John? You know, John's related to a terrorist, and no wonder he tells those kind of stories, and that's why he works with Muslims and everything." No, the point is that the idea of praying for extremely unlikely things where we believe and we're expressing confidence that God can work even if we can't figure out how he can work. And continuing in doing that, even when, "Well, I've been praying for Muhammad for 3 months now and he hasn't come to the Lord yet." Okay, how long did it take for people praying for me to come to the Lord? I don't know what Muhammad's eternal state is going to be. I do know what my responsibility can be. And I do know that it's kind of fun when I think about, I'm going to pray now for Muhammad, and I then have to discipline myself to just pray being confident in God. It's neat. Oh, and the next slide. All right, that one says, now is the time. Oh, I didn't take it all up, so you still have some time. Now is the time to say, if you have any questions, you know, did I spark anything? Did I insult anybody? Did you say, I've had this question I wanted to ask, but he didn't even touch near it. Here's your chance. Once. I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
In the jail ministry, when we go to our sign-ups, lately the Christian sign-up is modest. Right behind it is the Islam class, and it can be 2 pages. What are they telling people that's attracting them for their incarceration?
Okay. Well, I have two friends. Now the level of friends that I'm talking about, I am the grandfather to his son. Okay, he runs to me if I go to a Muslim event. This little boy will run across the room and jump up in my arms. And all right. So that's this one friend, his father. And then the other friend just recently got married. And when they did the passing the microphone around, they said, "Oh, we have a special guest who's going to say a few words, the Reverend John Elias." Okay, so these are our friends.
Yeah.
Okay, they're both Muslim. They are both obviously Muslim. They are both in high positions within the organization that they're part of, but they work as chaplains in prisons. And so what is being said? Well, actually, unique and interesting, they're both neo. They're both neo-Islamic. And so my one friend says, you know, John, he says, I had to grow a beard because these people that are in prison, the Islam that they come from and some of the things they believe, they won't even listen to me if I don't have a beard because they say the prophet had a beard, so I have to have a beard. So I grow a beard. He says, but that's so that I can talk to them and try to help them to straighten out their lives and, you know, and realize, you know, that they've done wrong and give them comfort or whatever. So it's possible that the chaplain that is doing that leading is coming from a relatively healthy thing, saying, you guys have really messed up, you deserve to be here, but you're going to serve your time, you're going to get out, make something of your life. Or he could be, they could be one of the it's got to mean more type of guys, and he's there saying, you see what Western society has done to you. Yeah. So I don't know. Now, you go to that, it might be kind of interesting to talk to the prison authorities and say, you know, we've been coming here, the guys, who's the leader? Do you think it would be possible for us to meet him sometime? Whoever leads up that ministry, you know, to give a call and say, you know, Abdul, you know, you're leading the prison ministry, Islamic group and everything like that. I'm leading the Christian one. Just thought it might be fun to chat sometime. Can we get together for coffee? And if he says, you dirty infidel, I don't want to have anything to do with you, well, that gives you an indication. You know, you can read behind between the lines and everything like that. Most likely he'll say, hey, that sounds a really pretty good idea. You know, where do you want to go? And then you go there and you talk. You know, that key word. So that's how you sort of find out from that. Oh. No, no, okay, yes, thank you, sweetheart, yeah. Well, I was sort of thinking, I'm sorry, that the here is a dinosaur Western guy who has been working with Muslims for a long time, thinking that obviously the leader of the ministry is going to be a male. It won't be, okay. Well, then recruit a male, because... But if it's Fatima that's leading it, but it's not going to be Fatima leading a ministry to men prisoners. But if it's women prisoners, maybe it would be Fatima. So, but again, first question is, who's leading it? And if they say Fatima, good chance that it's a woman, give her a call. If it's Abdul, good chance it's a guy, get a guy to give a call. But, you know, it breaks the ground. And then all of a sudden, you know, out of that, it's like you're confusing them. You know, you're confusing them because Muslims are taught, and the experience that they have is that Christians really don't believe anything. All right, because the United States is a Christian country. Britney Spears is a Christian. You know, Miley Cyrus you know, is a Christian. These are fine examples of Christian women and Christian men, you know, well, so, and Christians don't believe, you know, because look at the sin, look at what's been done as far as sexuality, look at what's done with abortion, look at this, that, and everything. So Christians don't believe anything. Plus, the other thing is that the religious groups that have had the most contact with Muslim groups have been the liberal groups, who don't believe anything. And so they're right in their assessment, in a sense. So if they run into a Christian, a real Christian, who believes what they, you know, and lives what they say they believe, it confuses them. And it's like, oh, well, she must be an anomaly. But then if they meet another one and another, all of a sudden, they start to learn. You know, my one friend who's a chaplain said he started driving for Uber. He says, I know you and Karen, and you're good people. You're good. He said, but I wanted to find out what other Americans that weren't like you were like. And so I drive for Uber, and now I see drunk people and this and that and everything. He says, I see the other side, and I really appreciate you guys more. But it's like, be discovered and confuse them, because you're real and genuine. Go ahead.
Occasionally, we get an admitted Muslim in our small
group. Uh-huh.
What a couple of key, the two ways of looking at the writing. The one gal, she refused the Bible because she was just coming together.
And you could point out to her, do you know the Quran says that you should read the Bible? You know, do you know that the Quran says that you should, if you have any questions about what you believe, you should ask a Christian?
Really?
Yeah. In fact, on the literature that I'm not mentioning, it's good that I'm not being videoed, because I can walk back here now and find one that has the right passage as I throw it on the ground. Here we are. Surah 11, which is Islamic Arabic for chapter, so in the Quran, chapter 10, verse 94, says, if you were in doubt as to what we have revealed unto you, then ask those who have been reading the book from before you. So what Muhammad, or what the revelation of Allah is to Muhammad, is saying, if you don't understand what this revelation is, the Quran, then go to the people of the book, the Bible, who have been reading it for a long time before you. So, yeah, Surah 10:94 says, if you have questions about your faith, you should talk to us. And there's other places, and if you go to our website, which is bridgesoption.org, and under resources, there are a whole lot of booklets. And one of the booklets is called Should Muslims Read the Quran? Ooh, and you can probably guess what that's all about. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Should Muslims Read the Bible? Hey, when you get to my age, you can do that. That's why I have a young wife. All right, yes. Should Muslims Read the Bible? Yeah, okay. Yes, first the young lady and then the old guy. Yes. The sun's in my eyes, so take it. Oh, that's the Bible. That's the Bible. So how in the world could you get a copy of the Quran in English? All right. I love questions like that. Actually, if you ever did go to a mosque, and seriously, this would be something to think about, you know, keep an eye out, you know, keep your ears open for if one of these local mosques does something. And then get together, you know, who would like to go visit? You know, get 10 people, somebody official from the church calls up to the mosque and says, "Hi, I am pastor, elder, high potentate, whatever. We have from New Life Community Church. We have 12 people that would like to come to your festival, to your fair, to your community dinner, to your whatever they're doing. Is that okay?" And they'll say, "Yes, this would be terrific," and then they'll welcome you. Well, two things will happen. One is that because you're coming together as a group from the church with your leader, they're not going to do the trying to recruit and evangelize you, because they're going to know. All right, now, it's much different than if you walked in all by yourself and said, "Hi, I'm all by myself, and I would like to find out more about Islam. They'll say, "Oh, good, a potential convert." You go as a group, it's much better. And two, by letting them know ahead of time, they will give you copies of the Quran. They'll probably feed you special and do all kinds of nice things in making you feel warm, cuddly, and welcome. So you got first question. I only have one copy of the Quran, so don't anybody else ask the same question. It's not going to have the same result. And in the last 2 minutes, the young man behind. Terrific. This not a plant. He's genuine. I don't know who he is. But yes, this is one of my biggest gripes about Christians, and it's our lack of fairness, integrity, and all when we're dealing with the Quran. Because many so-called Christian writer groups, whatever, radio programs, will have no problem with yanking a verse completely out of context and taking it super hyper literally and saying, "See what Muslims believe." And if they used that same technique with the Bible, we would be terribly upset. In our reading the other day, it ended up, the last verse ended up about dashing the little ones' heads on the stones. Some of these same groups that do that with the Quran, if they did that to the Bible, we'd be horrified. That's not the right thing. That's not the fair thing. There's enough wrong with the Quran and with Islam that we don't have to be non-academic, unfair, unchristian about our approach. So thank you. That's an excellent question. And it is, respect. This person who I have come to know, because that's the most effective way is not to knocking on doors of Muslims and handing them a tract or something like that. But it's knowing somebody and talking and being real in their life and a part of it. And men begin talking about what's vital to you, Jesus. That's where you get the credibility and everything. And we want to be fair and honest with them. They've got struggles. They probably believe. My friend believes very, very much in what? In Islam. Oh, actually, another friend that I've been doing Bible studies with believes very much in Islam. But Karen listened to him talking to me the other day and answering a question as we were we're studying the Book of Romans now. and she says, it almost sounds like he's becoming a Christian and he doesn't know it. All right, he's in a process. And now if I banged him, and attacked him and tried to yank the Quran out of context and that, man, talk about closing doors.
I guess
there's
kind of a follow-up question. I didn't want to say, but okay. Other
yes and no.
We're gonna have to wrap up.
Okay, with that, yes and no. We have to wrap up. And some of them are, but many of them aren't. Many of them can legitimately say there's a historical context. It's sort of like the story in the Quran where Joshua is supposed to go in and kill everybody. Oh, no, it's not in the Quran. It's the Bible. Yeah, okay. Yes, some are legitimately, but other ones, there's no way to dance around. Thank you. We're done.